Well, get used to things, isn't it? Get the PA all adjusted. There we go. This morning we're meeting with all the adult classes here in this room for a couple of very important reasons. One of which is we're having a little bit of difficulty trying to decide where to assign the classes and where they should meet. With the younger folks, it's easier. And by the way, is the the younger kids and even the teenagers, we know where to assign those classes because we know how many of them there are because they're departmentalized according to their ages. But with the adults, we have more of an elective opportunity, and it's a little bit difficult for us to know just exactly where to put these classes. If we base the location of the classes on the size of the room that you used to meet in, that will give us a certain amount of information. But we might want to reconsider or consider basing the classes on the amount of interest and need of the information that's going to be taught in those classes. There was one class, for example, over that was meeting over in the school building that was very, very crowded. And there was some tremendous help being given to the people over there. The auditorium class, of course, had the biggest room and therefore tended to be the biggest class. But we're not sure that the auditorium class needs to remain in the auditorium. It may be that if we specialize our emphasis a little bit, that some of the folks might want to meet in the other places. And then we had two other adult classes, as well as our college class and our career class, for a total of six classes, some of which were meeting off-site. And as we began to make the assignments for the classes, we really had a struggle knowing who to put where. And we didn't want to just take the classes that were small before and try to find some corner to stick them in here, because we thought maybe one of the reasons that they haven't flourished is because of their meeting place. And so we're going to evaluate this morning where we're going to be. We've got a questionnaire that we want to give everybody, and they should be being passed out to you right now. And we'd like for you to fill this out for us, okay? And this is going to help us this week to make some decisions about where we're going to put these classes, all right? Now, I'm going to talk you through this questionnaire, and then we're going to study some other things this morning, okay? And so we'll remind me if I forget, okay? We're going to look at the questionnaire here for a little bit, and then we'll talk about a Bible lesson this morning that perhaps will be a blessing to you, okay? Now, since this is our first Sunday here at West Lee, we'd like to have you help us evaluate our adult Sunday school classes. So if you would take a few moments and complete this questionnaire. We're trying to measure priorities and needs and concerns of our people as we make the assignments for the classes. All right? Now, we're asking you to put your name and phone number on here. This is not the kind of questionnaire where there's going to be any confidential information asked for. It's not the kind of thing that we're going to publish far and wide. This is just for the pastors. All right? And as we look over this material, we'll be able to make some decisions. So please give us your name and phone number if you could, because we may need to call you to get clarification about your interests, or we may need to call you to see if you'd be willing to help us in some way with these Sunday school assignments. Okay? Now, when we say which Sunday school class do you presently attend, obviously what we mean by that is, have you been attending? If you know the name of the class, put down the name of the class. The auditorium class had a name, it's called the Faith Builders class. Most people don't call it that. They call it the auditorium class. And that basically tends to be the visitors and leftovers class. Okay? In other words, whoever doesn't know where else to go, that's where they end up. The class that was meeting in the school building, I'm drawing a complete blank. The parenting class, or the focus on the family class, a lot of people still call it the Melodies in Marriage. We don't use that anymore, do you? Okay, all right, the parenting class. All right, and that basically is the family emphasis class. Dr. Henson's class is the Berean class, and then the class that Willie Galley has been teaching is called the Favorites of Faith. Okay. And so those are the four basic classes. Then we also have the college class and the career class. Now, the career class is the one that's been meeting at Dr. Harris's home. All right? And all these folks should be with us here in the auditorium today. What are you presently studying, or what have you been studying in that class? Put the theme or the topic, the scripture, whatever it might be. All right? And then, after you've done that, if you would, please rate the following areas of your need or responsibility and select no more than two choices in each category. You can select two, all right? No more than two choices in each category. And if you have any questions about what they mean, feel free to ask me, okay? Notice, for example, you have on becoming a leader, you have very important, somewhat important. And then you can say either my needs are being met already in this area, or I'd rather help somebody else be a leader. And just tell us honestly. Now, we really need for you to do this for us, okay? And if you feel that the particular question does not have an adequate response to reflect your heart or your situation, if you would, then briefly write in something that you think reflects your need or responsibility in that area. By the way, it's good to see Mrs. Frank today. There she is. How are you feeling today? Bless your heart. We sure have been praying for you. All right, good. Good to have you here. Okay, so you take a few minutes and fill that out, okay? Does anybody need one that didn't get one? And by the way, it'd be good for individuals to have them. Some of you folks say, well, I'll have my husband fill mine out, or I'll have my wife fill mine out. We'd like for both of you to fill one out, okay? So if you didn't get one, raise that hand real high, ushers. Here we go. Got a few more hands over here. All righty. Okay, now while you're working on that, remember, we're going to have a lot of challenges here in this building. And in our adjustment. We're all going to have to be real sweet Christians. Running a few short? Okay, we'll get a few copies made for you real quick, okay? We'll get those taken care of, and when they come back in with them, fellas, let me know when you've got them in, and we'll get those out to the other folks that didn't get a chance to get one, okay? We'll collect those real quick. But we've got to look positively. We've got to be able to look at our situation in the best light possible and have good attitudes about things. You know, you can always have a good attitude, even if your circumstance is not what you desire. I heard a story about these two fellows that were in jail. And they were army guys. They were in jail. And one of them says, how long are you in for? And he said, 30 days. He said, 30 days? What'd you do? He said, drunk driving. Oh, man, that's too bad. He said, how long are you in for? And he said, 3 days. 3 days? He said, what'd you do? He said, I shot the general. He said, wait a minute now. I'm in for drunk driving. I got 30 days. And you're in for shooting a general and you got 3 days? How do you figure that? And he says, they're hanging me Thursday. Okay. Now, that's a good positive attitude, isn't it? Okay. Now, we need to take a look at our situation and be as gracious as we can. By the way, during the work days, there have been a number of folks that have really been impressed with the testimony of our people. The fellow that laid our carpet, somebody told me that he's going to be trying to come to our dedication service. And he spoke to several of our men yesterday about the testimony of the spirit in which the people work together here. That was just a real blessing to hear. And he was excited about what he saw in our church here and in the attitudes of the people who were here. And I'm blessed with that too. This doesn't seem like the same place we came to a year ago December on that cold day to dig a hole in the ground, does it? Huh? Isn't the Lord good? And we're talking about a dedication service possibly for the 8th of May. 8th of May. That'll give us a little time to get some of these other things done. And my, how much the guys got done in the courtyard last night. Could you believe that? Those of you who were here yesterday morning, they were here for the wee hours. And they didn't get much sleep, but I see several of them here. They really worked hard. Okay, any questions on the questionnaire? Okay. Explain G. Building a team to help me fulfill a ministry vision. What, that part of it? Okay, in other words, how important is it to you to enlist or edify or develop others to help you accomplish something that is important to you? Do you feel that you have a burden for something that you would like to see done? Do you have a ministry goal in mind and you know that you can't do it alone, so you would like for others to get that burden and share that with you? Is there something that's very important to you in serving the Lord that you know is going to take others to get done and you are excited about helping others develop those abilities? Does that help? All right. Anything else? Any others? How many of you are done? Great. All right, we'll take a few more minutes for you to get those finished. I won't interrupt you. I'll just give you a few minutes of quiet time to get that done, all right? People talk. Good. Explain J. All right. Is Jay here today? Learning to study the Bible for yourself. The emphasis in that one is on for yourself. In other words, are you interested in an environment in your class where you learn skills and abilities in Bible study so that you can then do some research on your own? It doesn't necessarily mean like preparing sermons and those kinds of things. It means, would you rather learn the Bible in a class where you are being taught, or would you rather learn principles and guidelines in a class where you can then go and learn, use those same techniques to study the Bible for yourself? Yes. Oh, the choices. You have a problem with the choices? Okay. Well, actually, I really believe, Pastor Dixon, are you here? He's making copies. That question was supposed to have been changed. Okay? So now those of you who've got this filled out in ink, that question is supposed to say, learning to study the Bible in a group. Okay? That was supposed to have been changed to say, learning to study the Bible in a group, or studying the Bible in a group. Okay? So change that question if you would. Would one of you ushers tell Pastor Dixon about that? Everybody's hearing it. Everybody's hearing it. So when he comes with the new copies, change Jay to read, learning to study the Bible in a group. Mark it out and change it. Okay? Now, that way the answers say, I learn more in this setting. In other words, I learn more from Bible study when I'm with a group, or I'd rather study the Bible personally. Okay? So that question was supposed to have been changed, but apparently didn't get changed. Does that help? That makes more sense, doesn't it? Okay, anything else? Okay, how are we doing? How many have you done now? A few more. How many need more time? How many of you aren't doing this? Okay. All right. Yes. Okay. Have they got here with the copies yet? No. They're coming. Isn't that great? We can now make copies without somebody having to get in their car and go somewhere. How did you feel about, this is not on the questionnaire, but how did you feel about being able to bring your entire family to one place for church and Sunday school? Was that good? That's good? You didn't have to make a lot of drop-offs and delivery and things like that? That's good. All right. Okay, now let's get this done. Okay? Who's not done? Who needs a little bit more time? Okay? Any questions about it? Okay, go ahead and finish those up. Now, fellas, when you get in here, wave at me real big so I can see you. So let me know that they're here. I'll tell you the questionnaires are here. If you didn't get one, raise your hand and the ushers will bring it to you. All right? Okay. All right, give me just one more minute here to give. We're going to give these folks just another second or two here, okay? Okay, open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 14, just a few minutes. Joshua chapter 14. It looks like the copies are coming. They're here. Raise your hands real high if you didn't get one. They'll get you one. You go ahead and take a few minutes, fill that out, all right? And then we'll take them up a little later, all right? Here you go. Raise them up real high for the rest of you can see. Here they are. With the copies. All right, Joshua chapter 14. Verse 6. Very familiar passage of Scripture, but I want to show you something from it that you might never have thought of before, or perhaps have not studied in this particular context. Joshua chapter 14 and verse 6. Then the children of Judah came unto Joshua in Gilgal. That's where the camp was while they were having their military campaign against the land of Canaan. They would go out and attack certain cities, claim victory over those cities, drive out the wicked inhabitants of those cities, execute them, claim their cities according to the promise of God. Then they would go back to their camp in Gilgal. All right? So they're in Gilgal. And Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said unto him, Thou knowest the thing that the Lord said unto Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea. 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to espy out the land. And I brought him word again as it was in mine heart. Nevertheless, my brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people melt. But I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses sware on that day, saying, Surely the land whereon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance, and thy children's forever, because thou hast wholly followed the Lord my God. And now, behold, the Lord hath kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, even since the Lord spake this word unto Moses, while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. And now, lo, I am this day 85 years old. As yet I am as strong as this day as I was in the day that Moses sent me. As my strength was then, even so is my strength now, for war, both to go out and to come in. Now therefore give me this mountain, whereof the Lord spake in that day. For thou heardest in that day how the Anakims were there, and that the cities were great and fenced. If so be the Lord will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. And Joshua blessed him, and gave unto Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, Hebron, for an inheritance. Let's go ahead and read the next few verses too. Hebron therefore became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, unto this day, because that he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. And the name of Hebron before was Kirjath Arba, which Arba was a great man among the Anakims, and the land had rest from war. Kirjath means city. City of Arba, city of this giant. All right. In these verses, we have one of the most precious stories of all the time of the conquest of the Hebrews as they went into the land of Canaan. You remember the story. 45 years before, that's 40 years of wandering and 5 years of war. 45 years before, the people of Israel had come to Kadesh Barnea, having been delivered by God's grace from Egypt. They came to Kadesh Barnea, which was the place of crossing over into the land. And they sent these 12 spies into the land. Caleb and Joshua and 10 other fellows whose names nobody remembers because they were unfaithful and unbelieving. They went into the land and they spied it out and they saw how good it was, but they also saw how much work there was to do. And they came back and they said various things. Caleb and Joshua gave a faithful report. The 10 men said, we'll never make it. We'll never be able to do this. It's too much. There are giants in there, and they have walled cities, and it's over our heads. We can't do it. And Joshua and Caleb said, yes, we can, because God promised it to us. God told us we could. We need to go for it. All right? And they tried to encourage the people, but the 10 spies had discouraged the hearts of the people, and all the people said, we'd have been better off dying in Egypt. What an unbelieving attitude. These are the people who had crossed over the Red Sea on dry ground. These are the people who drunk water out of the rock. These are the people who were eating manna in the wilderness. These are the people whom God intended to bless and who had seen great and marvelous miracles. They had witnessed the 10 plagues against Egypt. And now they're saying, we'd have been better off just dying in Egypt than to go through all this. As a result of that, they spent the next 40 years wandering in the wilderness. And those 40 years that they spent wandering in the wilderness literally consumed everybody over 20 years old. 1,600,000 of them died in the wilderness. I ran the numbers on that a while back. I figured it up one time, figuring all of them died, but only the ones above 20 did. That means that on an average, every single day, for 7 days a week, from dawn until dark, they had 6.5 funerals an hour for 40 years. Joshua and Caleb and everybody else who had been under 20 years old. That means that the oldest man in Israel at this time is about 60. 40 years plus the 20. And Caleb is 25 years older than the oldest man. He was 40.
And for 45 years, he had wandered with the others. He suffered the same consequences they did. But now he was ready to go in, and he stood there and he said, "You remember how God told us we would get this land. Now, Joshua, I want it. Okay, and I'm ready to go get it." And the amazing thing about it was, even though Hebron and its environs, and there were about 11 cities in that area, even though that particular area had been one of the areas that Joshua had attacked in one of those lightning raids across the southern part of the country when they went over and really captured the Philistine area and got it under control, there were still many enemies there. Now, you need to understand something about military strategy in order to really appreciate the fact that Joshua wholly obeyed the Lord. There are two amazing things about the book of Joshua. It says that God did everything he said he was going to do, and Joshua did everything he was told to do, and yet the children of Israel never, ever fully claimed their land. Now, how can that be? Here's how it's so. Joshua, the general of the armies of Israel, was responsible for subduing and bringing into submission the territory. And he did that. He conquered militarily the territory and got control of it, even though he didn't clean up all of the rebels who were in that area, the rebels against God. Now, here's how Joshua can be said to be completely obedient, and yet there still remain enemies in the land. Has everybody ever wondered how he can balance those two things out? Okay. I'm not sure how much you know about military history, but let's use, for example, Douglas MacArthur's conquest of the South Pacific. All right? His strategy was to cut off the supply lines, claim the airfields, which are on the islands, and get to Japan and bring it into submission as quickly as possible. His military strategy did not consist of moving from one island to the next and exterminating every enemy soldier in the process. In fact, Douglas MacArthur, who was, for all practical purposes, personally the government in Japan after the war, was a very benevolent dictator during the time of occupation after World War II. He called to America and said, "Send me 1,000 missionaries." He couldn't get them, but he knew that the people were open and teachable. And he appealed to our government and said, "Let's be gracious occupiers of this country, and let's teach these people a right way of living, a capitalist government, and let's help them become a productive society." And because of the foundations that were laid during that time of occupation, the late 40s especially, Japan is a mighty, mighty economic superpower today. Now, they have their problems, of course, but that was begun then. Now, it was not Douglas MacArthur's purpose to totally destroy this society or to totally destroy these people. Now, God did tell the children of Israel to kill every inhabitant of the land. Why? That seems so unmerciful. These were wicked, vile, Satan-worshipping, child-sacrificing, abominable people. And for 400 years, God had put up with their vile behavior. And now He was going to wipe them out, and He was going to use the army of Israel to do it. Now, that may sound like an awful, brutal thing, but you've got to understand that it's like killing a snake. These people were corrupt, and they were going to corrupt others, and they had. And they hated God, and they worshiped false gods, and so on. So God's going to wipe them out. But Joshua's job was to subdue the land militarily so the other people who claimed their inheritance could go in and mop up their territory. And Joshua did that, and God kept His promise by allowing the children of Israel to go in. He divided up the land. He gave them all their place, and then they didn't do their job. They went in and many times fell in love with these heathen and became like them, you see. And that's a tragedy. Well, what MacArthur did, when he went to Australia, when he left the Philippines, and you all know the story there, Corregidor and the horrible battle and that sort of thing. Maybe some of you are familiar with that. And when he escaped and made his famous statement, "I shall return," he did. And that was his objective. And so he fled to Australia and there organized his invading army. And his strategy was to go into a particular island and subdue that island and get control of the airfields, bring in the Air Corps, refuel, repair, rearm, and go and attack the next island. And oftentimes, our army would be bringing in the airplanes and the supplies and the fuel and all those kinds of things onto the airstrips while the infantry was still fighting the enemy on the skirts of the runway. Is anybody in here in that war that has personal knowledge of what I'm talking about? Okay, you know, all right, so some of you all know about what I'm saying, okay? All right, now, correct me if I'm making mistakes here. I don't think I am. But let's use, for example, Iwo Jima, all right? Iwo Jima was, and you know where Iwo Jima is. It's over there in the Pacific, and you know, what's famous about Iwo Jima? The Marine statue of the five guys raising the flag on, who knows the name of the mountain? Mount Suribachi, okay? Now, they attacked that island and just pounded it into dust. I mean, it was a big mountain, and they killed every tree on the island, and they knocked down all the vegetation, and they just literally plowed that island up and just bombarded it. Now, you've got to understand what an artillery shell looks like. You know those big battleships and gunships that they have? And they got these huge cannon that come out there, and these things shoot projectiles that are the size of cars. And they explode, 2,000-pound shells. Now, the Japanese are dug in to this system of underground tunnels, and they're down in Mount Suribachi, and they're underground. And they're just plowing and pounding this thing. I mean, it's unbelievable. You remember the stories that came out of the pounding that we gave Iraq before the invasion over there, and how there were guys crawling out of the ground with their ears bleeding and you know, deafened for life and all this kind of thing. And, you know, you can imagine. And for days, over 2 weeks, every day, all day, our ships pounded that island and just destroyed it. And you would think, well, that's the end of that. And then the armies of invasion went ashore. And when they did, up out of the ground like a million ants came the Japanese and fought like you wouldn't believe. And they fought them and fought them and fought them. And we had many, many, many casualties. And all the way up the side of that mountain, and the Japanese are coming out of the side of the mountain, and finally the Marines got the top, and they ran up the flag. You know what was going on all over the island while they were running that flag up? People were killing each other. Okay? And that was what was so great. But now, why is that statue and that story so significant in American history? Not because we had totally destroyed them in one decisive battle, but because our men were still fighting and still dying and still keeping the battle going on while that was happening. That was extremely dangerous. And those men knew that raising the flag and claiming that thing was the way of building morale and encouragement for the battle in our troops. And they risked their lives to go up there and raise that flag. And then, of course, they cleaned off one side of the island, pushed the Japanese to the other side of the island, and then they began to go in and repair the runway, which they had been destroying for the last 2 weeks, okay? And they got that all cleaned off. The engineers come in, the CBs, or whatever you want to call them, and they plowed things down and put the runways down, brought the airplanes in, and while the battle's still going on, planes are coming and going to the next island. And there were times when MacArthur totally bypassed an island. He'd cut off the supply lines, you know, bomb big holes into the runways, and just forget it. And sometimes leave as many as 100,000 Japanese soldiers stranded on an island to spend the rest of the war trying to find something to eat because nobody was bringing him anything. That was his strategy. And he just jumped from island to island and moved through so quickly that there were times that, you know, and Nimitz, of course, supplied him. If it hadn't been for that, he would have been halfway to Japan and wouldn't have been able to get any fuel. It was a very strategic battle. Now, that's what Joshua did. And if you study the battle, you'll find how Joshua took the armies in there and just hit city after city. Hebron was one of those cities. And they had subdued it and got it under control. But there were still people living there, and they were still enemies of God and still enemies of Israel. Joshua had done what he was supposed to do. Now, the next group had to come in and clean the place up. And Hebron was one of the places that nobody wanted to have to clean up. Why? Because there were giants there. Okay? But Caleb said, "Let me at them." All right? He wanted to go and claim that place. And he did, even though he was the oldest man, perhaps with the exception of Joshua at this point, and a vigorous warrior, 85 years old, and went up against those giants and claimed that place. Now, I want to show you some scriptures today to show you a little bit more of the context. What perhaps motivated Caleb in this situation and why he was so excited about it. Turn with me back to Genesis chapter 13 and verse 18. Let's go back in Hebrew history almost 500 years. 500 years ago before this story. Now, how far back would that be in American history? This is 1994. You know what was going on in 1494? Columbus had just gotten here 2 years ago. Not much going on. How, what was America like in 1494? They say there wasn't much here, except whoever was here before us. Now, in a similar way, that's how far back in Hebrew history we're going to go. Genesis chapter 13, verse 14. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land and the length of it and the breadth of it, and I will give it unto thee. And Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. It was the place where Abraham went to live after Lot had claimed what he thought was the best land. And God said to Abraham, I got something I want to show you. A blessing you've never dreamed of. Come on over here. And he brought him over to Hebron. He said, here you go, Abram. It's all yours. I'm going to give it to you, and I'm going to give it to your children, and I'm going to bless you there, and I'm going to use you, and I'm going to make a mighty nation of you. And all these things that he'd been promising to Abraham now for two chapters in our Bible, since back in Genesis 12, he said, this is where it's going to happen. Now, this was in Judah, some miles south of Jerusalem. The area of Judah goes all the way up to Jerusalem, and it was in the south area there in the very beautiful part of the country. Now, look at Genesis 23 and verse 2. Genesis 23 and verse 2 says, or verse 1 says, and Sarah was 107 and 20 years old. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, the same as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. It's where Sarah died. The patriarch lived and traveled in and around this region. His wife died there. He buried her there. You know, this month, Hebron has been in the news. There were a number of Israelis killed there just recently. Still struggles going on. Still battles happening in that same city to this day. And that's where Abraham and Sarah are buried. The cave of Machpelah is in that area, very nearby. Now look over at Numbers chapter 13 and verse 22. It's about 450 years later. After this, the armies there, the Hebrews have been down in Egypt now. They've lived down there as slaves. They've been delivered. They have come now to Kadesh Barnea. Numbers 13, verse 27, or verse 17, I'm sorry. Verse 17. And Moses sent them out to spy out the land of Canaan, and said unto them, get you up this way southward, and go up into the mountain, and see the land, that what it is, and the people that dwelleth therein, whether they be strong or weak, few or many, and what the land is that they dwell in, whether it be good or bad, and what cities they be that they dwell in, whether in tents or in strongholds. Now, wait, let me ask you a question. Was there anything wrong with what Moses was doing? Was this a lack of faith on his part? God had already told him, I'm going to give you the land. Why was he sending in spies? We know later on, Joshua sent spies in too. But it says he sent them in secretly. Now, why did he send them in secretly? When he sent them in and they went to Jericho, it wasn't that he sent them in without Jericho's knowledge. That's a given. He sent them in without the knowledge of the people of Israel. Why? Because he didn't want this happening again, I think. Okay? In other words, there are two very important principles that you constantly see. On the one hand, they're claiming the promises of God. On the other hand, they're using good, sensible strategy. You see? A lot of times people think that if you use good, sensible strategy, that you're somehow not trusting the Lord. But then on the other hand, if you really are trusting the Lord, then you use those skills and talents and abilities under God's leadership that He has given to you. Joshua was a brilliant military general, one of the most brilliant in history. If you've ever studied anything about military history and you compare the campaigns of Joshua and you see the way he cut that nation off and the military campaigns, you draw yourself some little arrows about where he was going. He was brilliant the way he accomplished this. Brilliant. He used strategy, but he trusted the Lord. You see, when you really trust God and you want to obey God, that's when you take all the talents God's given you and you sharpen them to your best and you use them for Him. You're not trusting God to say, well, you know, whatever God's going to do, God's going to do, and I'll just sit back and watch it happen. Yeah, and God will use somebody else to make it happen, too, you see. So, He's using good military strategy here. And what the land is, whether it be fat or lean, whether there be wood therein or not, and be ye of good courage, and bring of the fruit of the land. Now the time was of the time of the first ripe grapes. So they went up and searched the land. Look here, where they went. From the wilderness of Zin unto Rehob, as men come to Hamath. And they ascended by the south and came unto Hebron, where Ahiman and Shishai and Talmai, the children of Anak, were. You know who these are? Big, bad guys. Okay? Three big giants who were well known all in that area. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. And they came unto the brook of Eshcol, and cut down from thence a branch with one cluster of grapes, and they bare it between two upon a staff, and they brought of the pomegranates and of the figs. The place was called the brook Eshcol, because of the cluster of grapes which the children of Israel cut down from thence. And they returned from searching of the land after 40 days. So one of the key places that they went to find out what was going on there was Hebron. And while they were in Hebron, what did they see? They saw the cities and the families and the evidence of the presence of the giants. And what was it that discouraged the people? It was what they saw in Hebron. Now that adds a little significance to what Caleb said, doesn't it? It was not only that he wanted that particular mountain. That's where Abraham had first lived when he came to the promised land. That's where the children of Israel saw and were discouraged. Now, you know what is on the national seal of the state of Israel today? Two men with a staff between their shoulders and a huge cluster of grapes. That scene is depicted on the national seal of the state of Israel today. I've got a symbol of it on a little copper plate over in my office. Now, that is a tremendous story in Hebrew history. And those two fellows coming back, and there's only two of them, not 12 of them. Okay? Coming back to say, this is a good place. It's a wonderful place. Now look at it. 10 fellows saw it and said, we'll never make it. 2 fellows saw it and said, we have found something great. It's wonderful. Only problem is, we've got to get these giants out of there. And as soon as we take care of that, we are going to have us a wonderful place. You see, that's the way they looked at it. Now, folks, we've killed a few giants to get in this place. God's killed them for us. But you know what? There's still some giants lurking around in a few places. Okay? Now, what does that mean? That means there's a lot of projects yet to do. There's a lot of needs still in our lives. We have an awful lot of growing to do. We have a long way to go. Okay? By the grace of God, we have come this far. And by the grace of God, we will continue to move forward. We need to claim what God has promised to us. Now, look quickly at Joshua chapter 10 and verse 36. Here was the earliest military campaign that Joshua got involved in. And we'll not have time to go into all this. I've used some illustrations about it so far. But in Joshua chapter 10 and verse 34, look at it. And from Lachish, Joshua passed unto Eglon, and all Israel with him, and they encamped against it and fought against it. Where are they? Where are the cities? You know where they are? You recognize those names? In the south, southwest. Who lived in those cities? The Philistines did. All right? And they took it on that day and smote it with the edge of the sword, and all the souls that were therein he utterly destroyed that day, according to all that he had done to Lachish. And Joshua went up from Eglon, and all Israel with him, unto Hebron. And they fought against it. And they took it and smote it with the edge of the sword, and the king thereof, and all the cities thereof, and all the souls that were there. And he left none remaining according to all that he had done to Eglon, but destroyed it utterly, and all the souls that were therein. Now, how do you reconcile that with the fact that Caleb has to go and kill the giants? Well, let me ask you a question. After they defeated Eglon and Lachish, were there any Philistines left? Sure there were. There were plenty of them. They headed for the hills. They had all their cousins living out in the caves. I mean, they took off and went and stayed with neighbors for a while, apparently, because after a while, they came back in and the Philistines became the most harassing influence in all the history of Israel, especially under David. You see? And those same cities became places of great torment all throughout the kingdom era under David and Solomon and so on. Now, the same is true of Hebron. Joshua got a military victory over it, and he subdued it, and he killed all the people who were there, and he didn't spare one of them. What that means is it was not Joshua's fault that there were still some enemies there. He did everything God told him to do. Later on, when we come to chapter 14, we know that Caleb still has to go in and clean things up. And all throughout chapters 14, 15, 16, long in there, in the book of Joshua, in our daily reading this week, okay, we've been reading this story. Where do you think I got this idea? Okay? And they are basically, we're talking about dividing up the land. And it gives all the borders. Now, I know sometimes you read through that and you think, I don't know where these places are. Well, get you an atlas or get you a map, get you a pencil, and start doing some tracing. And you'll, oh, that's where that is. Okay? And you know what you'll find out? You'll find out that the half-tribe of Manasseh, for example, and Reuben and Gad, you know where those guys were? They're over the Golan Heights. You know what's going on there today? They're drawing the battle lines of the next war. That's what they're doing. Okay? And that's what they've always done since 1917. Fought over that place. Why? Because that's where the headwaters of the Jordan River are. And so we're going to give it back to Syria. And you know what Syria's going to do? Same thing they've always done. They're going to cut Israel's water off. And then Israel's going to have to go up and bomb them into oblivion again. Okay? That's what always happens. It's happened about a half a dozen times in my lifetime. You see? And it's going to happen again, too. Because it just keeps on happening. Everybody says, well, we all just need to get along. You see? Well, as long as you've got a whole religion over there that's promised heaven for killing a Jew or a Christian, I don't think we're going to have peace, do you? And that's what's going on over there. All right, enough political commentary. But they had a military campaign, went in and claimed the city, but they still haven't conquered it. Next, we come to chapter 14, which we read today. Here in Joshua, and Caleb came up and said, look, I'm 85 years old. I've trusted God all along. God's brought me all this way. I want to go in there and get what God promised to me. Now, that's where Abraham lived. That's where I went when I told the people we could do this. Now, I'm ready to go do it. I've been waiting 45 years to go do this, he said. Let's get in there and let's claim this place for God. God gave it to Abraham. Now, if he gave it to Abraham 500 years ago, surely we ought to be able to go in there and get it. That's basically what he's saying. Get it. Joshua said, do it. Okay? So he went in and got it. And he motivated some people. He told his nephew, Othniel, who became a judge in Israel. He told all the fellows, he said, anybody who goes up here and gets this city, I'll give my daughter to be his wife. Othniel says, I'm on my way. So Othniel goes up and he gets it. He gives him Achsah, his daughter, who was also his cousin, by the way, Othniel's cousin. He gets the city. And then his daughter comes to him and says, by the way, now, Dad, if you're gonna bless us now, I want you to really bless us, okay? You've given us the upper springs, now we need some lower springs, too. Now, where do you think Achsah, Caleb's daughter, learned that principle of asking for the whole blessing? She learned that from her dad, didn't she? She'd watched her dad, and her dad had said, hey, listen, God promised this thing to us, now let's go up there and get it. Now, here's his daughter saying, yeah, that's right. You know, let's go get it. So she learned something, and she was motivated, and she was excited about that. And she went up there, and he gave it to her. Now, I want to show you something you might not have thought about. Turn to Joshua chapter 21 and verse 13. And this is the whole point of the message. Okay? So all you people who are having to go and do other things, please go read Joshua 21, 13. Okay? All you choir and everything like that. Okay? Joshua 21, 13. See, they're illustrating what this verse teaches. Look at verse 9 of chapter 21. And they gave out of the tribe of the children of Judah and out of the tribe of the children of Simeon these cities which are herein mentioned by name, which the children of Aaron, being of the family of the Kohathites, who were of the children of Levi, had, for theirs was the first lot. Wait a minute, what's going on here?
They have just finished dividing the whole land. They've given every tribe possessions all over the land except one tribe. What tribe? Levi. Why? Because their heritage was the priesthood. Only problem is, they got to live somewhere. Right? They've got to live somewhere. So what they did is they took cities from each of the tribes and gave them to the Levites to live in. Okay? And here's what they did. And they gave them the city of Arba, the father of Anak, which city is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah, with the suburbs thereof round about it. After Caleb had gone in there and claimed it, and had fought for it, and had defended it and risked his life for it, you know what they did? He gave it back to God. He gave it back to God. And Israel took it and built the parsonage on it. That's what they did. And said, here you go, we're going to let the Levites live there. Isn't that amazing? Give me this mountain. Why? So I can give it back to God. Is that a wonderful story? And you know, you go on to read in the history of Israel, and you'll see in the days ahead, in 2 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 1, after Saul died, you know where David was and where he was anointed by the people to be the king? Yeah, it was in Hebron, in the area around Hebron, in those cities, in that area. And later on in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, you know where David reigned for the first 7 years, 6 months of his kingdom? Hebron. That's where the kingdom began under David. It's where he was ruling before they went up. Now, what did that symbolize in the history of Israel? This was a Levite city now. It's where the priests live. It's where the message of God was being proclaimed. Caleb had risked his life for it. He claimed it for God. Then he gave it up to God. And because he gave it up to God, then later, when God established the kingdom under David, which became a picture of his own kingdom that's coming someday, he began that kingdom in Hebron. And that's where the foundation was laid, there in that city. What a wonderful story that is. And later on, you'll find out that when Rehoboam was fortifying the cities in the south to be able to protect the southern kingdom, God told Rehoboam, don't you fight against your brothers. Now, Jeroboam's up here in the northern kingdom wreaking havoc and starting a civil war and causing all kinds of problems. And Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, was down there. He said, you fortify the cities, you make them strong, you defend yourself, but you don't attack. You know, one of the cities that he armed and built and made strong so that that would be the case in 2 Chronicles 11:10? Hebron was one of those fortified cities. Why? Because it was a precious place in the history of Israel. That's one of the reasons that there's all this fighting going on over there right now. Later on, in Nehemiah chapter 11 and verse 25, after the people came back from captivity, they moved into Jerusalem, they built the wall, they built the temple, and then they began to repopulate the country. And you know what one of the first cities was that they repopulated, according to Nehemiah 11:25? One of the first cities they moved into after they had reestablished their capital at Jerusalem, Hebron. Hebron, a wonderful place. It's where Abraham's buried to this day. Now, what's the point? The point is, in our application, we've said, give me this mountain. We've wandered in the wilderness for a lot of years. When we moved over to Buncombe Road, signed a 5-year lease, I can still remember then, and I've said this to you recently, several folks said, we're making a big mistake. If we commit ourselves to staying in this building for 5 years, we'll never be here 5 years. 13 years ago, we were having that discussion. Okay? I remember when we came over here and looked at this land, and when I first began to share the vision, and some of the men began to say, you know, I believe God will do that for us. I believe God's going to work this out. I think God's really going to do that. Some of the folks were saying, yes, let's do this. Let's go for it. Let's get in there. And some of the folks were saying, I don't think it'll happen. I don't think we can do it. I think we're biting off more than we can chew. I think it's too big a job. And some of those people have been discouraged, and some of them have discouraged others. But some of those same people, I look out across the faces here today, I look at Ted Harris over there, and I think to myself, what a Caleb. What a Caleb. All throughout this process, let's just get in there and get it done. Let's go claim it. Let's just go get it. And some of you new folks who've come along, some of you, bless your heart, you've been born in the wilderness. Okay? I was out here last night. I left here last night after 1 o'clock. And Dan Albert was out there with Ron Burns and a bunch of kids laying pavers in the courtyard. And when I came in this morning, there's a whole lot of pavers that weren't there at 1 o'clock. I don't know how long those guys were here. But at least he had time to go and get a shower, and he's here this morning. What am I saying? I'm saying that Buddy Day out there claiming the mountain, you see. All right, now, we've got the mountain. But let's remember, Caleb was the man he was because he did this for the glory of God. Now, we're going to take these questionnaires. I want you to pass those to the center. Pass them to the center or to the aisles. The guys are coming down the aisles. Just get those questionnaires picked up real quick. And we're going to take these questionnaires and we're going to try to make some decisions about what we're going to do. Okay? Now, when we do that, wait just a minute. I'm going to get those. When we do that, you may have to give up your piece of the mountain for somebody else who wants to grow and serve God to live in. Okay? You may have thought, we're going to get this room or we're going to do this thing, and you may find out, like Caleb did, you got it for God and now somebody else is going to enjoy it. Okay? That may happen. But let's ask ourselves, what are we doing here? What are we doing here? Are we building this for ourselves to enjoy? This is not the millennium, folks. This is not our heavenly home. This is another tool. Thank God for it. Now we've got the mountain. Let's give it to God. Okay? And when we assign the Sunday school classes based on some of the information we get from this questionnaire, let's everybody be a Christian about it. Okay? All right. Praise the Lord. You come.